Stop waiting for permission to start your business. Your idea is one step away, and Shopify can make it easy to make it happen. That's what we did at Crypto 101 and use Shopify to sell our book, and the rest is history. The thing I like about Shopify is it takes the scary part out of starting. You're not just sitting there trying to figure out a website, payments, checkout, inventory, all these little things that stop people before they even launch. When I think about building a storefront, the biggest thing is friction. You want someone to land on your page, like what you're selling, and be able to buy without getting stuck. That's where Shopify is huge. Shopify Checkout is built to help more customers finish their purchase. And when they come back, their details are already saved. One tap and they're done. The cool part is Shopify powers millions of businesses worldwide, from huge brands that you know, like Mattel and Gymshark, to small businesses just getting started. So whether you're building the next big brand or launching your first product, the infrastructure is already there. Once that part is handled, you can focus on the real work, building the brand, getting attention, and bringing people to your storefront so the business can grow. That moment when someone actually buys, that's when the idea becomes real. With Shopify, nothing stands between your idea and a real business, so go make it one. Start your free trial today at shopify.com/crypto101. That's a free trial at shopify.com/crypto101.
All right, everybody. Welcome back to another episode of the Crypto 101 podcast. I'm your host, Bryce. As always, joined by my good buddy, Mr. Brendan Veman. Brendan, how are you doing in the sunny state of Florida?
I'm doing good. I'm happy to be here. I'm enduring the heat, and I'm really excited for this one. This is definitely one of those podcasts that interests me a lot. I know both of us have been seeing this guest, as I'll have you introduce in just a second, all over the place, and it really piqued our interest, so I'm stoked.
Yeah, no, this has been awesome. I'm actually a brokerage account holder at public.com. We've got the co-CEO and co-founder, Leif Abraham, joining us to talk about the future of not only public.com and everything they're building on the brokerage side, but really particularly the agentic side of trading and what that means using AI to enhance your workflows, enhance your research, enhance your trade execution, do it all. Leif Abraham, thank you for joining us. And how are you doing?
Good, well, thanks for having me. Doing fantastic.
Beautiful. Well, let's kick things off here. Tell us about the genesis of public.com and, you know, kind of what went into it with your co-founder and your co-CEO. You know, why'd you start this? What's the mission?
Yeah, I mean, so first off, Public is really a platform for people that kind of want to really build and compound their wealth over a long period of time. And when you kind of saw in our space, especially in the US, this kind of like first wave of fintech, it was really heavily focused on speculation. And we kind of thought like there's really a place to essentially build like in like the next generation's Schwab, essentially. Yeah. Something that you can trust with your life savings, that you can, you know, build sophisticated strategies in, and we can really like kind of compound your wealth, right? But with great design, with, you know, the newest technologies around, hence also why we're very, very deep, obviously, in how AI can impact people's portfolios and people's investing experiences and such. And that was really kind of like the like general genesis there.
Yeah, no, it's incredible. And, you know, for folks who don't have a public.com account, or maybe they have, like you said, a Schwab account or a Robinhood account or whatever, what would you say is the key differentiator between the competitors that you guys kind of face off with?
Yeah, it's a little bit like if you become more serious about your investing and you are on Robinhood, you will open up a public account, more asset classes, more things to be done, deeper, you know, fundamental analysis, you know, just something that's a little bit more for grownups, for lack of better wording. And if you're on Schwab and you click around, everything looks like a tax form. You might have a product depth in terms of asset classes. But, you know, once you realize that you're, you know, logging into a time machine every day that brings you back to the 90s, you recognize that maybe it's time to upgrade to something like Public. That would be my high-level pitch.
And real quick, is this for just mobile users or does this have a web interface as well?
No, we have a web interface too. Yeah, of course.
I know that that's something that a lot of our listeners really do enjoy. And they say, you know, some of them like to do it from their phones, but there's a lot of people that are traditional and they're like, hey, you know, we want that kind of web interface. So that's good to know.
Yeah, we still see, even with so to say, younger generations. We even still see that things like average deposit sizes and so on are much larger on the web. I think people still appreciate very much the sense of, like, when I sit down on my computer and I open up my browser and whatnot, like, I'm here to do serious work, you know? And I feel like that's what the web app still lends itself to. And we see it in the numbers as well, right?
Yeah, I got a question just on that. You know, you're saying, like, oh, you know, we see the users who are young, all that kind. I'm just curious, like, what does your user data tell us about the state of the economy, in a sense? Like, you know, you have a very unique sort of private data set that you guys could, you know, peer into. And then we get these, you know, public CPI reports, we get the jobs data, you know, inflation's volatile, jobs are kind of softening. What do you guys see? I'm just curious, like, what do you pay attention to? Any indicators that you could kind of clue us in on?
Yeah, let me think about this. On the small level, you could see that volatility always drives actions. And so, you know, when the markets are down, people buy the dip, you know, things like that. That's when we see like great deposit days. And so on. I think generally speaking, there's still a lot of money on the sidelines and people are just like deploying as they go.
Yeah.
And we, in our case, our users also just like deploy basically with every paycheck they're getting. If you look at the US, you can kind of, you know, if you want to, you can kind of divide it a little bit by income of folks. And so if you look at the top 25% in the US, essentially people that make more than $100,000 a year, and then the sub 75% make less than that. And in the sub 75, most people live paycheck to paycheck or credit card to credit card, right? And so there are not really many assets to deploy. They might trade some crypto in and out, you know, or they, you know, do some more speculative, you know, higher risk, higher reward kind of trades with prediction markets and, you know, options trading and so on, because, you know, there are not necessarily assets that compound. And so it's much more about the sense of like, can I win big here somewhere? And that's the risk that those people take, you know, and that's kind of what we're seeing. But our focus and who we're designing for is really for the top quartile. And so those are people that make more than 100 grand. They, you know, have the ability to compound in the markets because they have money left over every month with their paycheck. They inherit money, et cetera, right? If you look at the Great Wealth Transfer, which I'm sure you've all heard about, right? It's like a topic.
Yeah. The boomers.
but like, you know, it's like, what's the number? Like 84% of the Great Wealth Transfer, of the assets of the, like, you know, trillions of assets being passed down, will be passed down to the top 25% of digital natives.
Yeah.
And so in our space, that top quartile is literally where the money is at, you know, in terms of assets that could move onto a platform like ours. And so that's really like, well, just like design-wise even, and when we build features, like who's the customer we have in mind, it's really the person that sits in the top quartile. And therefore that lends itself also to like a little bit more sophisticated feature set. You know, these people care deeply about their taxes, right? We've done a lot of work on how you be able to manage your tax lots on the app, et cetera, et cetera. And so all these details are suddenly become very important if you're like designing for the top quartile.
Yeah, it's fascinating. It's the top quartile or the top part of the K, right? Everybody's talking about the K-shaped economy.
100%. And I think that is just, we're seeing how that becomes more true, you know? That you're really having these like two worlds in the US really where, you know, the top quartile can compound the markets. The markets are doing well, comparatively speaking, right? And so they will always get some great leverage and upside out of that. Versus if all the money you're making, you needed to spend, and you have inflation on top of that, it obviously gets harder for the people who are part of the kind of like sub 75, right?
Yeah. I think that, at least I personally believe that with this great wealth transfer coming from the boomers and the older generation to this maybe younger generation, I think that those people are more willing to invest that money than maybe the prior generation when they were our age. I think that you've seen a huge adoption or a huge increase in adoption of younger people wanting to invest and being incentivized to invest. And it feels as if there's been a huge push and kind of shift in that narrative, which I think is a good thing. And so targeting that and maybe even just trying to understand which assets could be most affected is something that everyone's trying to get ahead of the curve on, right? How is this going to affect everyone? and, you know, what's going to be kind of invested in. And over here, you know, obviously we're going to be a little bit biased, but this is a crypto podcast. And, you know, we believe that one of those areas that money can kind of go into is crypto. A lot of younger investors are interested or invested in crypto. Now, whether that's 1% or 100%, it can vary a lot there. But, you know, what do you kind of think about where crypto fits into all of this? And what has been public stance on crypto been?
Yeah. First, 100%. But we've really seen with this, like, kind of like digital natives, right? People that grew up with the internet around, is that they've also gained financial literacy way sooner in their lives. And that is because social media, access to information, you can have global niche communities with millions of people. I always make this example of there's communities around dividend investing, you know, and like YouTubers and who talk about dividend investing that have, like, you know, millions of subscribers and stuff. And I'm like, how much can you talk about dividend investing? But apparently it's a big thing. And so you really had this thing where a whole generation just, like, gained financial literacy earlier in their lives. And I think crypto was a big part of that because it's the first asset class that was born retail. It was not born, you know, the first people that got rich on crypto were not some hedge fund. It was, you know, regular people. And and also it was born fractional. It was the first asset class that was born fractional. And so, you know, you could get started with $20 if you wanted to and so on, right? And so I think that combination was a kind of very powerful thing for crypto. And I think it added to this notion that people had exposure to assets and to investing principles earlier in their lives because maybe they started actually with crypto, you know, and that kind of forced them to then, you know, guess you go out, be more mindful of financial literacy, like actually seeking it out more, you know, reading into it more, etc. And so, to what you're describing, I think crypto had a very big impact there as well, like on this generation, and the fact that these people, you know, invest early on in their lives and are just much more active in the markets and just more, call it like self-directed first, as like, you know, they are confident in their abilities as investors, so therefore they want to have an active hand in building it, not just give it up to a financial advisor. Right? And then with that, like, we've always looked at crypto as an asset class first, right? That's where we started off. And with that in mind, like, that generation of the digital natives, like, you know, they kind of grew up with it. And so there's always been this mindset of, like, part of their portfolio is allocated to crypto, you know? Mm-hmm. And we very heavily see that. We launched one thing, which is crypto IRAs. So essentially your ability to hold crypto within and, you know, within a retirement account, which then, you know, creates kind of two things, right? Because these are like tax deferred accounts, right? So you're not being taxed until you actually, you know, want to either withdraw the money after or you, you know, as you retire and so on. And so you can compound these dollars much more, even if you're active, right? So, which means number one, you can hold them to retirement and just kind of grow it there. But also if you trade, you don't immediately are being taxed on it, which means you have the ability, if you're a more active trader there, to then also kind of, you know, if you're successful in that, of course, that to kind of compound that those crypto gains in your portfolio much sooner and stuff. And I think those are the types of tools now that we're also seeing where it's gone out of the pure, you know, meme coin trading, you know, FOMO app or thing that just like spikes and dies within like 30 minutes and then no one touches the coin anymore and like stuff like that, you know, to something where there's a segment that really thinks about it as, here's an allocation of my life savings of a portfolio that I allocate to crypto. And now my next thing, if I do that, is to think about it as a serious investor and things like, what kind of tax advantage moves can I make, you know, and so on. And therefore, like, those interest buckets where things like crypto IRAs fall into and like those tools like a crypto IRA is really something that we've seen all the interest, you know, rise a lot in.
Yeah, that's fascinating. And it's a really good product. I haven't used it yet, but it's definitely something I'm super interested in. And now tell us, a lot of us are, you know, crypto traders, and maybe we'll use a platform like Coinbase to do a lot of our custody and trading. But tell us, you know, if we sign up for a public.com account, can we store our Bitcoin? Can we store, you know, several different assets? Can we stake? Is there any lending work or lending facilities that we could kind of contribute to earn a yield? And I know you guys acquired Zero Hash some time ago. to help with your crypto infrastructure. But tell us the extent of the crypto infrastructure, and especially in light of the Cold Card hack recently, a lot of people are taking self-custody and saying, oh, maybe this isn't for me. Maybe I should trust a brokerage account or something like that.
Yeah, yeah. And like, we didn't acquire Zero Hash, we just partnered with them.
Okay.
But fantastic company. And, you know, they help a bunch of big players, including like an E-Trade and stuff, also with their crypto offerings. And so, like, they're fantastic team and product. But long story short, and so on Public, you have access to around 60 coins. You can trade them, you can hold them, you can transfer them in and out, obviously. You have access to them either through the mobile app, through the web platform, or even through API. You know, we launched a trading API as well. So like on Public, you can just open up an account, go to settings, grab your API keys, go from there. We have MCP support, obviously, you know, in case you want to connect it to your Claude or, ChatGPT or whatever else you might pick. And so on. But then obviously also we have agents built within the Public platform, which we can talk about a little bit. That helps you kind of set up like more automated strategies on your crypto trading. And that has really been our focus. There's no staking yet. It will come eventually. And so just for you to continue to like earn some yield there and so on. But right now it's really like, it's like as seen as like an asset class as part of different asset classes on Public.
Everybody is talking about AI right now, but the AI that actually matters is the kind that saves you time, helps you make smarter decisions, and takes work off your plate. And if you're running an e-commerce business, shipping is one of those things that can either keep you moving or completely slow you down. That's why I like ShipStation. It's an end-to-end order fulfillment platform built for e-commerce businesses, and its AI is trained on decades of real shipping data from billions of shipments across the world. So instead of juggling a bunch of different tools, ShipStation helps you stay in control. It can alert you when your stock is low, recommend the best carrier selections and rates, automate tasks, and help you save time as you grow. You also get inventory syncing across sales channels, automatic rate shopping, a branded returns portal, and integrations with accounting and CRM software, all in one place. If I were running an e-commerce store, this is exactly the kind of tool I'd want, because once the orders start coming in, you don't want shipping to be the thing that's holding you back. Over 1 million businesses have trusted ShipStation to optimize and scale their shipping. The sooner you switch, the sooner you start saving time and money. Get started with ShipStation today and get 60 days free at ShipStation.com with code crypto. That's ShipStation.com, code crypto. ShipStation.com, code crypto. Taxes and fees apply. You know what slows teams down more than anything? It's not always the headcount budget or even the tools themselves. It's when the way work gets done lives in someone's head and never actually gets documented. Then someone new joins, a new platform gets rolled out, or a teammate leaves and suddenly everybody's doing the same process in a different way. That's exactly the problem today's sponsor, Scribe, was built to solve. Scribe is a workflow AI platform trusted by 94% of the Fortune 500. It captures workflows as they happen and turns them into step-by-step documentation your team can review and share. You just do the process like you normally would, and Scribe builds the guide as you go, capturing every click, step, and screenshot automatically. With our team being remote, I have definitely had moments where I've had to explain the same setup or process more than once to a colleague, and it always feels like something that should have been documented the first time. With Scribe, what could take hours of writing and cleanup can be ready to share in under a minute. Scribe also automatically redacts sensitive information like names, emails, and account numbers from screenshots. Admins can enforce that across the team so nothing slips through the cracks. Plus, anyone following the process can get real-time on-screen guidance showing exactly where to click inside the actual tool. Scribe doesn't just document workflows. It uses AI to suggest ways to improve them, helping you spot redundant steps and opportunities to simplify or automate. To see what Scribe could look like for your org, head to scribe.how/crypto101 and mention Crypto101 for your first month of Scribe Capture free on select plans. That's Scribe, scribe.how/crypto101.
Yeah, no, that makes a ton of sense. In the scope of, you know, different tools and products that you have, I think maybe the most interesting one that you just alluded to is this agentic trading platform. And I think there's a wait list. Luckily, I made it through the wait list. But tell us, you know, for people who haven't used it, or maybe even some people who are like, yeah, I've heard of ChatGPT, I've used it a little here and there. How does this work? How can I trust it? what kind of decisions is it making on its own relative to, you know, what permission does it need? Just give us the 101.
Yeah, for sure. So first, by the time this podcast goes out, maybe the waitlist is gone. So that is happening very, very soon. A little spoiler for you here. but long story short, so if you look at AI agents, first off, there is essentially two ways of how people think about it, right? So one is this just like MCP concept. And you've seen a bunch of trading apps launch with their MCPs, which is just like a wrapper around their API, essentially. And it's essentially like a little server that has instructions that like your Claude or ChatGPT or, you know, whatever can essentially access to kind of know how to deal with that API. And therefore, you know, you can connect your account and then just use, you know, say a Claude to try to set up some strategies and whatnot. Now, there's obviously some risk there because you're connecting to a third party. If, you know, Anthropic does an update to their model tomorrow, you don't know how it's going to behave tomorrow and so on. And so I put that still, it's very interesting. You can do it with public as well with our MCP. But I put it into like the tinkering camp, you know? So to your point, you know, you will likely set up a separate account for it. You know, put a little of play money into it to kind of play around and, you know, get some, you know, learn some things and so on. That I would have put into that camp, at least where it is right now. Then what we've done is on the other end of the spectrum, which is we have built AI agents directly into the public platform. And that, number one, has a security aspect to it because it's in your authenticated brokerage account. But also security aspect from it because the way we've designed it is to kind of separate the reasoning of the AI from the execution. And so you use the AI to kind of like spar and get to an outcome and like to, you know, determine a certain strategy that you want. Once the agent is created, it essentially creates a deterministic, you know, flow that it can't deviate from. And so that means there can't be hallucinations. It will do exactly what you told it to do. And therefore you have some reliability and trust to these systems. And we think that is very important because you need to be able to trust it in order to use it in your real account with real money and your real assets, right? And therefore, it should really be a thing that only does what you told it to do. And you will also, when you create an agent on public, you will see the exact workflow. You approve it yourself, so you know exactly what it will do and how it acts before you implement the agent. And so those are things we find very, very, very important, right? Another aspect we built in is really kind of like radical transparency. And so as an agent, you know, kind of does its actions or does not do actions, you have a full history of every single little thing the agent has done or also has not done. And so, for example, it checked something, the criteria wasn't hit. You will see that, you will know that. And we think that is another piece that is very, very, very important to basically give a lot of trust to these systems, right? That you know exactly what it's doing, what it's not doing, and therefore you can use it with real money in your real account, with your real assets, because all these safeguards are kind of built in. And so, you know, I put these two things out there as like two kind of separate, different kind of ways on you know, how you can interact with agents out there.
How have agents been used so far? Like, what areas do you see them being used the most frequently? Is it normal just trading like the S&P 500 and NASDAQ? Is it trading more traditional futures contracts? Is it crypto trading? Is it somewhere else? I'm curious.
Yeah. So obviously trading strategies is where everyone's minds go first, right? Yeah. And in that, you're basically seeing things like, you know, for example, something like, hey, if a certain stock, you know, trades below its 200-day moving average, you know, buy X amount of it in my account, you know, and don't do it more often than Y. We are seeing things like risk management of options contracts is something that's very popular. Mm-hmm. So you might have a bunch of options contracts rolling. You want to make sure they never exercise, you know, and so you have a certain criteria that just, and an agent just looks at all your contracts, and if it hits certain criteria, you know, you kind of, you know, sell out of them automatically, for example, you know. We see things like, you know, automatic buying the dip of, you know, certain assets and so on. Another thing I find very interesting is basically broad portfolio-based tax loss harvesting. And so, you know, there's tax loss harvesting as a strategy is something that also like a wealth advisor might do for you, you know, and basically looking. And most people think about it as something of like, oh, the year is ending, you know, before... You know, before I wrap up the year, like, let me, you know, let me see where I'm in the red and like sell those positions and put a reminder in three months from now of like, you know, if I want to rebuy into them or do something else with that money, you know, like things like that. Obviously, tax loss harvesting is something you should be doing throughout your entire year in theory, if you really want to maximize that strategy, right? And that is something that you can set up agents, obviously, very well for that. Can kind of look at your portfolio, look for opportunities and kind of help your tax loss harvest throughout the entire year, throughout all asset classes, throughout the entire portfolio, you know? So those things are very interesting. And then we also see, like, as people get started, that they basically set up agents, but then instead of making a trade immediately, they just set it up as an alert, you know? And they kind of get comfortable to the beginning. A little bit too, you know, Bryce, here, you kind of commented in the beginning of like, hey, you know, as we get started, you know, you kind of want to build your trust with these systems. And so instead of letting it trade, people set it up and just like lead to alerts first, for example. And so there's a lot of stuff like that, you know, that that we've seen agents do or that we've seen, you know, people use agents for so far.
I love it. And it's just version one right now. I look in the bottom and it says version 1.0 point something or other. I'm like, what's version two going to look like? You know, what's the future of this product?
I gotta tell you, I don't think there's a lot of science right now behind those versioning numbers. It's really just like whenever we update something, you know, those versioning numbers goes up. And to your point, it's like in like twofold increments and stuff. But but generally speaking, you know, behind the scenes, there's updates every single day on this stuff.
Okay.
The thing with building AI products is you don't always know what people will do and use them for and what all the use cases are. And so you kind of need to have these rollouts. Again, like we've launched this 4 months ago now. And like agents itself, right? Launched this 4 months ago now. And, you know, we've rolled it out with these rateless concept also because, you know, obviously we want to have a very clear eye on, you know, what experiences people have, but also what are the use cases so we can design around them, right? Because, you know, if you ask the agent to do something very specific, very niche, you know, we can actually also design elements, you know, within the system that just, you know, make it easier or like more intuitive, you know, to like set up a very specific niche agent and stuff like that. And you don't know until people use them, you know, of what all the possibilities are.
Yeah, no, it's such a, you know, a new world that we're entering into because it's not really about, you know, people's technical skills anymore that are really where a lot of the value is, right? I mean, I'm sure you know how to code or your, you know, your team is all coding and all that kind of stuff. And that used to be a really coveted skill. It's like, man, if I only knew how to code, then I'd be able to make all this money. Now anybody could go to Claude or to Public and just express what their thoughts. So the real value now is actually just in the thought, in the abstraction layer. Like, can you think of in human, you know, English language or whatever language you want, you know, what to do and, you know, how to, you know, prompt, right? And so it's just, it's cool that you guys are catering to that in a sense, you know.
100%. And there is also, you know, we're talking about always this thing of that trading went from clicking buttons to expressing intent.
Yes.
You know, where, and therefore it is one abstraction layer higher, you know, and where often you might have a rough idea and you will express that to the AI and it will help you refine it because there might be follow-up questions that it needs to turn into a strategy that you've never thought about, you know, because you maybe haven't had that, you know, level of sophistication before and so on. But then also you learn while doing because of that exchange that is happening, right?
Yeah.
And so that's 100%. And then I think one other aspect is when we kind of think about user interfaces and AI, right now, a lot of these interfaces, they just start with this blank prompt field. And that is actually a quite nerdy place to start because you must have some, you know, sophistication and understanding yourself in order to even come up with what to type into this blank field of opportunity, you know?
Yeah.
And so one thing we're rolling out now to is essentially a marketplace of agents. Where you created an agent, you can share it, you can publish it. other people can take it and customize it and make it their own. And so to create more inspiration there as well of all these possibilities, and kind of go away from this, like, everyone needs to already have a level of sophistication themselves in order to get started, because there's this blank field that you have to fill with, like, you know, human language prompt coding, for like a better wording, right?
Totally. And it could be daunting. Like, I've experienced that. It's like, wow, the world is my oyster here, you know, typing into the public agent, but what do I even want to trade? You know, what's going to outperform the S&P? Like, I can't just tell it, you know, think hard, outperform the S&P, go. Like, it needs some prompting and stuff. But
exactly. Because the running joke with agents has always been this, like, a bunch of people tweeted, you know,
make no mistakes.
Like, I was tweeting something like, make me a lot of money, make no mistakes. You know, and obviously that is not how things work, you know, and the way we often define it is like in this very first phase, it is really much more designed to turn your ideas into action. It is not necessarily yet designed to turn, you know, or to give you ideas. And that will evolve over time, of course, you know. So if I say you can give it a rough idea and then finesse it to basically get to a full, you know, fully formed agent, you know, I would say like that roughness of idea will obviously, you know, It will get to a point where you can give it rougher and rougher and rougher ideas, you know, to get to a fully formed agent. And so you will get more and more to this camp where it will help you create an idea, or it will, you know, refine your idea. And so it will blur this line of how much is it, you know, giving you an idea versus, you know, helping you turn your idea into an action, the kind of smarter and more developed this becomes, right?
It was funny. This reminds me, the other day there was a big report, you know, like these models, the foundational models, they're getting so smart. They're like solving all of these open math problems, right? And open, you know, questions that, you know, haven't been left unanswered for 50 or 100 years. And so there was this one like engineer from Anthropic, and there's this open hypothesis called the Riemann hypothesis. And the Claude Opus, or I think it was probably the Mythos class or something, all it was doing was the engineer, the person, was just saying, think harder, believe in yourself, you got this. And like, because it kept coming back with, oh, I can't figure it out, I can't do this, and it just kept prompting it with encouragement, and eventually it figured it out. And so this went viral on Twitter or X.
That's
right?
Incredible.
Because all the engineer was doing was just telling the AI agent, just keep trying, you know, think of a different angle, think out of the box, and it freaking did it. And so it's just a whole different world that we're living in. It's really just incredible. And it's just fun to think about. But to kind of, you know, put a bow on, you know, the AI agent product, I'm just curious if there will be any extension of the AI agent brain that you guys are building to eventually have it potentially even move off the brokerage account. And what I mean by that is, what's so cool about crypto is it's a bearer asset, it's digital, and you guys could have a crypto wallet functionality that could go and traverse DeFi or, you know, Morpho and Sky and all these different things. And it could do it on behalf of some registered user. And, you know, I could basically type into, you know, public, maybe, I don't know. Here's an idea for you, free of charge. But like, hey, go look for the best yields on DeFi and, you know, use the public wallet, and it would work. I mean, I'm just curious if you would ever have that as an idea.
No, 100%. And the way we think about it is that there is a sense of how much like decision making or free decision making do you give the agent? And I think it starts off with very little. You want to be as deterministic as possible to also build the trust. Then the second level becomes this thing where specific actions within an agent can have more freedom and own decision making. And to give you an example, you know, back to like agent going out into the internet, you know, you might be, hey, buy a company when it's rumored to be added to the S&P.
Right.
Now you're going to be like, so who makes the decision of what does rumored mean? You know, and you could be, okay, are you now going back and forth with the agent on like defining that specific criteria of like, which news sources do you trust, et cetera, blah, 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 you know? Or do you leave some, you know, open decision-making to the agent in that moment, which is obviously also a risk piece, let's be straight, you know? And the agent can go out and kind of like determine it themselves and be like, you know what? This person tweeted something, you know? And because of my assessment of XYZ, this is a source that, you know, I put a certain probability rating on or so on. And therefore, I take it as a rumor that, you know, we say is a yes in this workflow. And therefore, I've purchased this company now, you know?
Yeah.
And I think that applies to essentially any action on the internet that can be up for interpretation, you know? Yeah. And so... or any action that can be taken on the internet, generally speaking, you know, and I think that is definitely something that, you know, I think things are moving towards, but the nuances here really matter, right? So right now within public, for example, every data source that the agent has access to is something that is like directly plugged in. It's something that, you know,
lock and key.
It's like we might spend a lot of money on to get the specific feed from directly from NASDAQ or something, you know, and so on. And so these are like verified, trusted sources, you know, that the agent can make actions on. Mm-hmm. And the further you open that, you know, the further, you know, obviously also just like the quality of data source that the agent interprets, you know, might go down, you know, and might become a little bit like up for interpretation of how much do you believe this is a, you know, proper trustable source of data or not, you know? Totally. And that is really like those nuances is, I think, where this like open field thinking, open field action taken for an agent on the internet, you know, becomes important. And how do you as a user deal with, you know, how much freedom you give to the agent in that moment?
Yeah.
Yeah. On that topic, it kind of makes me think of, this isn't really a question, but just a comment, but like Chainlink, right? Like Chainlink, has these verified data sets that people can, you know, jack into and say, okay, I want this verified data source because I don't want any tampering to be in my agent's, you know, source and stuff. So I think in the world, I mean, I actually don't have any exposure to Chainlink, so this isn't me like shilling my bags or anything, but I think it really does have a good place in the world as AI agents take off. They're going to need, you know, decentralized data sets that are verified. Because, you know, most people won't be able to afford a direct link to the NASDAQ. And so getting something that's maybe just similar, kind of as good, but it's verified, it's centralized, it's crowdsourced or whatever, could be interesting.
And I think it's also, you know, on public, you currently have this, like, you can use an agent to research or you can use an agent to just like build essentially like an execution workflow where it does actions on your behalf, right? And these two worlds are gonna merge, you know, quite soon. And, you know, as they merge, there's also this aspect of, you know, what is the data sets, not just sources, data sets that give you some edge, right? Mm-hmm. And so where right now in some hedge fund somewhere, someone will build, you know, some forecasting models and whatnot. And like, because they are proprietary to them and they're thinking, you know, that is the edge that they're creating. That is obviously something that in theory, anyone can do if they have the knowledge and the tools to do so. And AI is obviously one way to give people the knowledge and the tools to do that. And so you can very much see how you will essentially create something in crypto trading. It might be, you know, you might have a certain way to analyze, you know, what are important wallets and, you know, trying to figure out what are they buying when. And if you feel like, oh, there's a pattern that you have found to emerge, you know, when these specific wallets buy a coin, then, you know, that thing tends to go up at this moment in time, you know, et cetera, et cetera. and you will use, you know, AI to essentially do that research and then have that be an analysis that is like a living analysis, like an agent that will update automatically. And then you can take actions on the back of that with an agent. You know, those are the things that become, I think, super exciting in that moment because, you know, you can use AI not just to, here's my virtual workflow, but also to create unique data sets that are proprietary to yourself and your own thinking to then, you know, take actions on.
Well, one of the other things that really stood out to us was some of the pages that you all have, or information that you all have released here. And I think it happened back in April, but it was over like 60 different private companies that you all were tracking, including things like OpenAI and Anthropic and Stripe and What this does is it gives retail investors this kind of institutional grade data before the company's even IPO. So I was wondering if you could tell us a little bit more about that, because that has been a big push lately, is to either get more information, open up these private companies, and potentially even let people invest in them. And you've seen kind of, I would say, the groundwork for that be really laid on crypto with tokenization first. But again, now you guys are kind of bringing it to the next level and saying, not only can you maybe get access to it, again, depending on where you go, and I'd be curious to hear if you can do that on public, but also get this institutional grade data as well.
Yeah, exactly. I think, first off, obviously we're living in a world where companies now go public so much later in their life.
Mm-hmm.
Because because the private markets have become so mature that there's so much money in the private markets, and they're actually in the late stages are fairly liquid, you know, they're to a point where, you know, these companies just have the luxury that they don't have to go public, right? Back in the day when, like, you know, Google and so on went public when they were, you know, a few years old and, you know, at like a few billion dollars valuations and stuff. They did that because they had to, because there were not enough big funds that they could raise money from. So like for them to raise money, they had to go to the public markets. And so they had to IPO. That is just not the case anymore. And so therefore you have companies go public way later in their life when they're way larger and so on. And so now you're getting to a point where you have $1 trillion companies, you know, like Anthropic, like is at this stage and so on, you know, or Spectre just has been, that go public at a point where, at the point where they go public, they're top 10 largest company in the world, you know, like is insane. Like that is just such a different world. And so first off, that just means that, you know, yes, there is a delay between when retail and regular people have access to them and, you know, their own kind of need to you know, have this kind of broad liquidity and such. And I think that's bad for the health of the financial markets. You know, like US now has what, sub 4,000 public companies that used to be close to double that, you know, 20 years ago or so. And so that is not necessarily healthy because it also creates, you know, concentration in the markets. Like we're all invested in the same companies at the end of the day.
Yeah.
You know, and so on. And so even just for the health of the US financial markets, I think it's not necessarily a good thing. Now, for like, you know, regular retail investors, that means number one, yes, I think there needs to be much more, you know, call it innovation, for lack of better wording, around how these people can get access to these companies sooner. That is, I think it's not just a regulatory, it's not just a technological question of like tokenization and stuff. Like that's just a wrapper at the end of the day, you know, like the instrument. I think it's very much a regulatory question, you know, accreditation laws, basically like who's allowed to invest in them, financial disclosures, you know, like what do you need, what access of information do you have on these companies so you can do a real analysis on the value of what you're buying, you know, and so on. And so there's, I think, a lot of work that needs to get done to really, you know, enable that. But then on the other end, on the company side, it also, I think nowadays, is that the journey to become a public company, even though the company goes public later, the journey might start sooner. Where it's not just going to be like, well, we filed for, you know, our S1 with the SEC now, and, you know, then we're going to do our roadshow and we're public and that's it. But now it's like you have something like Stripe that for years now has put out an annual report, an annual statement where they disclose some numbers, where they talk about the business, you know, where they do a big presentation that might talk about the business, you know, and so on. So like they're already kind of, you know, developing the muscle of what it means to report to the public, to, you know, what it means to be a public company, et cetera. And I think when that journey kind of starts sooner, that also starts sooner in terms of building a book of retail investors. And so what we think about it is that like, hey, we have these private companies on the platform. And number one, if there is opportunities to give people access to invest into these private companies, then, you know, maybe we can facilitate that on one end, depending on the instrument is and, you know, regulatory requirements and so on. But then on the other end, also on the company side, we can build already a following of retail investors for these companies. So when they eventually actually go public, you know, they've essentially done the, you know, communication and pre-roadshow kind of, you know, relationship building with potentially hundreds of thousands of retail investors before they actually file the S1, before they actually go public, and so on. And we find that very interesting as well, right? And so it kind of serves both sides of the of a market and a big out.
I love that. Yeah. And again, just kind of a comment, but like I imagine being a CEO of a public company is quite stressful, and there's so much red tape, and being the CEO of a private company is probably a lot less stressful and more enjoyable. And you don't have, you know, all sorts of different things that a public, you know, company might have to, you know, yeah, be beholden to and so on. So I think that's probably another reason they're like, hey, like if we don't have to do it, let's delay it as much as possible. By the way, are you guys public or private?
We're private.
You're private.
But like, there's like private. A sense of like, I often public is private still for now. And I was talking about this thing, like if you're a public company CEO, you have to be the type of person that gets energy out of essentially like pitching your company and marketing your company all the time. You know, like you're becoming a hype man if you're a public company CEO. And so if you're someone who's like dreading to go on an earnings call and you just want to get it over with, you know, you're likely
don't
go
public.
You're likely not going to be a great public company CEO. But if you're someone who's like, I'm going to pitch the shit out of this thing. I cannot wait for this earnings call to happen. I'm going to show these people, you know, like that needs to be the mantra, right? And you kind of see that with like with companies that have CEOs who embrace it, who love to do that, who get energy out of it. You also see how their public market comes from like an investor relations perspective change. You know, suddenly the call becomes a video call, you know? Suddenly the whole setup is closer to like a, you know, wrap up after a sports game, like the, you know, the interview with the coach and stuff, you know?
Yeah.
Suddenly, you know, you're not just doing it once a quarter, but you're going to host events where you're going to talk about, you know, your numbers and whatnot, maybe even on a monthly basis, you know, et cetera, et cetera. And so I do think it's very like, depends on the type of person that you are as a CEO. And I think there's actually a bunch of people that will get joy out of it and actually maybe even command an even higher multiple because of it, because they have the skill set to tell a really good story.
Wow.
I think I'd be a pretty good public CEO, don't you think, Brennan?
I think so too. I could see Bryce on those earnings calls crushing the numbers.
I get fired up, man. People call me the ultimate crypto hype man. So I definitely, I would just need a great company. But anyhow, Brennan,
you got a great company.
Yeah, no, I know. I don't want to go public anytime soon.
Yeah. Well, one of the other big talking points here outside of these has been the prediction markets. I mean, people in traditional finance are talking about them. People in crypto are talking about them. It has been the talk of the town for what feels like at least a year now. And it's something that you've had a decent amount to say on the topic, right? Because you have people that look at it through very different lenses. You have the, dare I say, the degenerate gambling side of things, who people love to get into it and get involved. But then you have people that are hedging with prediction markets, and they're using it for other purposes as well. You've kind of drawn a clear line between prediction markets as portfolio tools versus sports betting. Can you talk to us a little bit more about that and how these two worlds kind of collide?
Yeah, I say prediction markets, aka events contracts, is a fairly old instrument, right? Like weather contracts were introduced in the 90s and stuff for commodities traders to kind of hedge their positions and so on. So like that instrument has been around for a while, but retail access to the instrument has basically been non-existent. And you had obviously a bunch of regulatory changes in terms of what this instrument can be applied to. And therefore, I would say that, you know, the use case of an events contract has been stretched, right? Hence, you know, suddenly it's being used for sports betting. It's being used for, you know, if Ronaldo's going to cry or not. You know, and so on. And so it has been stretched, right? Exactly to your point, I think what that means for the instrument itself, I think it quickly gets a bad rap because it just gets seen as this, you know, new age casino thing, you know, that is just being used for just, you know, degenerate gamblers, and that's kind of it. And even though on the other side actually is a real financial instrument that also has and can have a lot of value, especially for some more sophisticated investors, right? And then obviously the other piece also is it's an instrument, but it also a data source. And so how we think about it is, you know, and you know, we're going into prediction markets soon as well. But we think about it as like, essentially, it is a way for you to trade the events that move the markets. And so things that are related to your portfolio. And that might be because you're able to dissect an earnings call. I always make this example of like, if you're like a big Tesla fan, you know, and you have a really good grip on their energy business and you've built your own forecasting model and like you, you know, whatnot, and you just understand that business really well, you want to place a trade on that. And you don't want to be bogged down by, you know, them not hitting their Model Y numbers, you know, for example. Yeah. And so those are things that I find very, you know, important and meaningful because, you know, people have certain skills and have certain understandings of certain things, and companies become these like big behemoth things that has 50 different business lines, you know. And so being able to dissect company performance into like smaller pieces, I think is, for example, a very great use case, you know. The other thing is also, obviously, you know, we are very deep in AI agents. And so, you know, they can like that data can be used for other things as well. And, you know, one, you know, example that we talk about internally is, for example, a thing that like, hey, you might look at the market of the Fed rate and you'd be, okay, if, you know, the probability in the contract of the Fed to raise rates, you know, next quarter goes up over 70%, sell my treasuries.
Yeah.
You know, which is a bonds trade, like one of the most boring things you can imagine, you know, and so on. And so suddenly you can have this thing that right now is kind of being viewed as this like very degenerate gambler kind of thing, you know, but it can actually have very meaningful value for someone who's a bonds trader, you know. And stuff. And so, and those are the things that we are personally quite excited about. And it's, again, it's principally, we think about it as it's the events that have an impact on your portfolio, AKA the events that move the markets, you know? And the reality is if Ronaldo is going to cry or not, it's not going to move the markets.
And I think that that could bring more liquidity and excitement to some of those areas that I would say the average young investor doesn't get a lot of interest out of, right? If you think about probably the person my age in their 20s and 30s, or maybe even younger that invests, I don't know the last time I've heard any of them talk about wanting to do treasuries or bonds or any of that, and even caring other than how it affects the risk on markets. So maybe that does add a little bit more relatability. Maybe it incentivizes them a bit more to actually care and get involved with those. If it does, it increases liquidity, it increases interest. And I also think that the better people understand those kind of tools like treasuries and bonds and other stuff that you were talking about, I think the more that the average investor understands those, the better it is for everyone because there's general market knowledge that comes from that.
Yeah. No, 100%, 100%. And I would also always look at like, I think the opportunity in prediction markets, aka events contracts, is more in really the market stuff. Because if you look at the volumes coming from like actual institutional investing and so on, like it's, you know, I don't know, like, you know, 100 times more than what, you know, the sports betting market in the US is, you know, for retail. Mm-hmm. And the average trade size is going to be tremendously more, right? Like right now, if you see like the little, your numbers that are popping up on a chart on Kalshi or something, it's like $5, $20, $50, $15, you know? And like, you can add two zeros to that, you know, if you go into just like retail investing, you can actually add four zeros to that if you go into institutional, right? And so it's just like, there is, I think the opportunity there is, you know, just way larger. And that's the stuff that we're excited about.
I love it. Well, look, Life, while we still have you for just a handful of minutes more, I do have a little lightning round question answer I wanted to just run by you to make sure we've really sufficiently grokked everything at public. But is a little lightning round sound cool? Four or five questions, something like that?
Cool. Go for it.
Okay. I know we got to get out of here at the top of the hour. So real quick, is, you know, what's the number one coolest feature that we haven't discussed yet about public?
Jesus Christ. Number one. Okay. Income Hub. Your ability to see all the money you make from yield and bond payments and high yield cash and dividends and then project it out into the future.
Love it. That's a great one. Is public as safe as a bank?
I would say we're safer than a bank. And if you've ever worked in financial services and tech, you will be mind boggled by how the industry is built on top of FTP servers with CSV files. That is effing ridiculous. We have one engineer on the team who is a very, very, very senior, great engineer. And he always has this like doomsday story that he tells where he's like, just based off how old all these companies are built and the technology stacks that are built in COBOL and whatnot, where he's like, one day, one of these banks and one of these brokerages will go down and they will not go back up.
Oof, scary. All right. So I love that. the other one was when marketplace? When is the marketplace going to be open for us to look at everybody's and copy trade essentially?
Within weeks.
Ooh, okay. I like it. Within weeks. Another question. I know you have a background in gaming as well, from your past life. But why did crypto gaming never take off, and will it?
By the way, that is like a long time ago, especially teenager, pre-teenager, like out of my kids' room somewhere. I actually still think it will, and I think it's just a question of which company is going to go into it. And I think if you look at Valve and, you know, the way they just said you have a marketplace of skins and stuff like that in Counter-Strike, I think they've kind of nailed it, obviously, already. And I think it's just that to create a real marketplace there, you need also these concepts like decay, right? Like if you buy a skin on Counter-Strike and you use it, the value will go down the more you use it until it hits zero. And therefore, it creates... You know, therefore, like, it's like burning tokens, right? It's like, and so I think concepts like that maybe haven't been used and figured out. But I think, you know, having like a cross-game currency, I think someone will end up doing it.
Bitcoin or Ethereum? If you could only choose one.
Bitcoin.
Not financial advice, but also not a single hesitation in that. and then last question, I know we've kind of already talked about, you know, so many things that are headed in the future for public, but just the roadmap, any other thing that we haven't really discussed, obviously marketplace, improving agentic trading, more crypto capabilities, what's left? What gets you up in the day that you're like, oh man, we got to go finish this. We got to go start this. What's on the roadmap?
I think we have a roadmap that is literally will keep us busy for the next decade. And so that is the beauty in this business, that we're not lacking ideas. We're just lacking time and, you know, resources to get them done as fast as humanly possible.
Beautiful. Life Abraham, co-CEO, co-founder of public.com. Thank you so much for joining us, everybody. Check the show notes. We'll have some links in there for you guys, but it's easy. Go to public.com, sign up for an account, let them know you came from Crypto 101 podcast, and hopefully we'll see you guys on the platform. And Life, please do come back. Don't make yourself a stranger. We'd love to have you back, whether it's in a quarter or in a year. Tell us some more updates. We want to just keep tabs on everything you got going on.
Awesome. Thanks, guys.
Awesome. Thank you so much. Take care, everybody.